Our newcomers and our guests, blah, blah, blah. What should they know? I thought one of the people should not everybody knows my wife. She's here.
See you.
Behind me. And this very special tonight, our dear friend, Rabbi Nataf. Rabbi Nataf was our educational director. We miss him very much. We are very pleased and very honored that tonight is coming to us and let's say a few briefs. Afterwards, I understand that the IO continuum has a very difficult game for us to play. And for the rest, please make use of all the food, which is all prepared by my wife, and enjoy it. And it's great that you're here at home in a more social setting. And let's make a nice evening out of this. Hope to see you soon again.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi Cardozo. It's a pleasure to be here among old friends and new friends who I haven't met. And maybe I haven't met. I remember these events and always being of the opinion that the main purpose is social. So even though it's not my business anymore what you do with your events, I will follow that approach, and in two ways. By number one, keeping it to 10 minutes. Hopefully within 10 minutes I can still say something significant. So it's a feat that rabbis have problems with, saying something significant in a short amount of time. I'm not going to take questions as a group, because I don't want it to go beyond that, especially when I hear there's a proper group game scheduled. So that's really much more appropriate for the evening. So in any case, I'll just mention something that is connected to this coming week's parsha, Parshat Yitro. As you know, over there, the commandment of Shabbat is Zachor, Zachor Tzimur Shabbat. And in Sefer Purim, we read Shamor at Shabbat, right? To guard, to keep, here it's to remember, there it's to guard. So the Midrash, famous Midrash, everybody knows it, right? That B'dibor Echad Nemru, and Mechilta says, they were said at the same time, D'var she'efshal basar v'dam, something that's impossible for a person to do. So I use that as a metaphor for my understanding of how we're supposed to approach Torah. That many people in the world of literature have been arguing for many decades about the notion of authorial intent, the intention of the author. And when we study literature, are we interested in what the author meant by what he wrote? Are we completely uninterested, or somewhere in between? So my understanding, I wrote about this more at length in the introduction to my first book on Bereshit, Redeeming Relevance, that this problem is not a problem by divine literature. The issue of wanting to know what the author had in mind is only a big issue if the author is limited. But the paradigm of God being able to do two things at once is a paradigm that we can take into the Torah itself. That in fact, his words can mean, not only can he say two things at once, but his word, the Dvar Hashem, can also mean two things at once. I bring several proofs from that from famous commentators that point out that in specific cases God said something that was designed specifically to be understood in more than one way. And that, as I understand, is the notion of the Torah being an open book that is readable in all sorts of different ways, all of them being valid. Perhaps this is an idea that predates the postmodernist approach to reality, to truth. But again, one doesn't have to be a postmodernist to see that as a legitimate vision of a divine work and not a human work where there are unlimited possibilities. Now, the question might arise if there are many, if there's multiplicity of meaning already implied in the text and appropriate in the text, does that mean that all options are available? And are there better interpretations than others? I think that first of all, once, I've argued before, once you have the possibility of two, once you have the possibility that it means more than one thing, so it opens it up to all possibilities. And as if you're saying it's not definitely one thing, then presumably it can be any variety of possible understandings. But that's a variety of possible understandings. Also, such a thing as a mistake. You know, it's possible to misread something, so also misunderstand something. I think all serious postmodernists would agree that the fact that there are different ways to look at truth doesn't mean that every possible statement is automatically valid. There's also such a thing as a mistake or something that's invalid. But what's more interesting to me, I think that's davar pashut, and that's a simple thing, and anyone who's thinking would realize that there are things that can't be said. But what's more interesting is the notion of, is there a spectrum of validity? You know, are some interpretations more valid than others? Right? Is there something that makes more sense than another interpretation? If both are possible, and God in fact implies both, or three, or five, or 20, or 70, really we should say, if there's 70 possibilities, are they all equal? Or is there a gradation? So it's interesting, Maharal in the Be'er HaGola, who speaks about, as at least according to what I have here, it's on page 20 of the Be'er HaGola, he brings a beautiful mashal, where he speaks about objects being complex. Complex, in his term, he's speaking about the four cardinal elements that used to be understood as the basic building blocks of all things, right? Water, earth, fire, and air. But in our modern chemical terms, the same thing is true. Things are compound. Everything is made up of complex structures of different chemicals. Even water is really not just water, it's broken down. It's complex, it's made of different elements. And the Maharal says, therefore, when there's a machloket, when there's a disagreement whether something is tame or tahor, pure or impure, so usually, if we have serious people who are arguing, they're both finding something that's real in the object. In other words, according to the Maharal, It's all objects are complex, meaning they're compounds, a better word for it, meaning they're both pure and impure. The only question is it more pure than impure, or vice versa? That's really the question. He says, as a result, both opinions are gufei Torah, both opinions are valid, both opinions are really involved in interpreting and understanding Torah in valid ways. The only question is, what's more valid? That's really when you have a machlok discussion in the Gemara, so it's a question of, we're not saying that your opinion is invalid, mine is correct, but rather which one is more valid. That's the way the Maharal sees it. I think that's very helpful. But if that's true, then one might wonder, why is it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't help us out? You know, as if there's a more valid opinion than the other, wouldn't it be better? You know, sometimes this is more valid. And as you said, we're saying they're both true, elu, but it's not just that we have to make a decision for the sake of halakha, but rather that there is one position, generally speaking, that's more correct than the other. If that's the case, so why not have Kadosh Baruch Hu tell us which one it is? Right, so I think that's the famous Gemara in Bava Metzia. Gemara in Bava Metzia, which you're all familiar, we love talking about over and over again, Tanu Shalachnai, where Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Elazar have this big cultural duel. It's an incredible story. And my reading, by the way, is that Rabbi Akiva's studentship is really at the core of this disagreement. Both Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Elazar want to be the teacher of Rabbi Akiva. And that's really the nexus of the fierceness of of the argument, because Rabbi Akiva sets the tone for the future of halakha. But be that as it may, it's very much an aside. The answer Rabbi Yeshua gives to Rabbi Eliezer after Batkul says the halakha knows, in this case, God explained which one was the more valid opinion. He says Rabbi Eliezer's opinion is in fact more valid than the opinion of Chachamim. So the question has to come, at least in my mind, maybe it's a straw man, but I don't think so. I think it's a very strong question, is why not? Why is it lo b'shamayim? In other words, granted, the Torah says lo b'shamayim, but one can ask the question before that. Why did God want to have it lo b'shamayim? If presumably the more valid thing has more meaning, more valid understanding has more meaning, it's closer to God's ultimate intention. In other words, there are several possible intentions, but perhaps there's a more ultimate intention, which is why there's something that's more valid than something else. So why should it be lo b'shamayim? Why shouldn't HaKadosh Baruch Hu inform us each time, okay, nice try Chachamim, but the halacha is like Rabbi Eliezer because that's a better opinion. And so too, again, ideal, this is a halachic discussion, but I think this it's even more of a question in the sense, even more of a question when it comes to Divrei Agadah and Parshanut, where there's on some level a greater openness to multiplicity. Right? Why, if the more multiplicity, the more room there is for chaos. Why not tell us, you know, the Ramban is correct and Rashi is wrong, and vice versa? Why can't there be batkols, right? Or some other mechanism. If batkols interferes with our with our free choice, right? Why can't there be a mechanism to help us find out what's the most valid interpretation of the text? So I think that there's a trade-off, and it's another theme of mine in Sefer Bereishit, is the notion of trade-offs, that God creates a world with trade-offs to make existence more meaningful. But if you, again, it's another Torah for another time. But essentially there is a trade-off that if you do that, if God tells us the answer, then he closes up the possibility of relationship with mankind, with the Jewish people, in particular with mankind. And it's more important to put that multiplicity and the possibility of less validity, as well as the possibility of error, all together in the Torah and allow it to be lo b'shamayim for us to be able to have partnership with God. To have partner, anybody knows that if you can determine the fate of the Torah, you're more interested in the Torah. Right? Obviously, determining the fate of the Torah doesn't mean you can say anything you want. But if it's our Torah, right, it's Torah Moshe, this is a Gemara in Kiddushin, actually, a beautiful Gemara, where they speak about the notion of whether a teacher of Torah, is allowed to forego his honor. In other words, if someone doesn't want to stand for him, right? Does the rabbi have the right to say, I don't care, you don't have to stand up for me? Or does he have to insist that the person has to stand up for him? It's not my thing to forgive. So the Gemara says a very interesting thing. It says that God forgives his honor, so certainly a scholar can forgive his honor. But then the Gemara says, but it's different, because God owns everything. He can do whatever he wants. The scholar doesn't own his honor. His honor really is a derivative of the Torah. The Torah doesn't belong to him. So the Gemara bring an interesting pasuk, not simple pshat, but essentially it says that that the Torah does belong to the scholar. It becomes his portion, something that he owns or she owns. And I think that's the bottom line. I think that's the bottom line here, that the Torah, that God, is interested in our ownership. As on an educational level, again, this is something that's very obvious to educators, that you want your students to have ownership over what they're dealing with. And we have this from the prime educator, and the primal chinuch, the Torah itself, that finds this amazing way to bring us in. And I can only say that in my own work, teaching as well as writing, Parshanut, I find it tremendously enticing. I find it tremendously rewarding to have that possibility there, and that's what I try to share with my own students in Talmud Torah, to understand that Talmud Torah is something that can become yours. I think it's tremendously important, and this is one of the forums where there's tremendous room for individuality and personal involvement in Torah. So without knowing what's going on in specific sessions, I urge you to make the Torah yours, in any involvement in Torah, to take that perspective that it's open to you, that it's waiting for your pirush, it's waiting for your interpretation. Again, that's not licensed to go on a rampage like a bull in China shop. You have to be careful. It's a holy document. But it's your document. It's Torah delay, as the Gemara says. It's his Torah, it's her Torah, it's your Torah. And Bezrat Hashem, you know, with that attitude, if we can not only have it for ourselves, but transmit that to our students as well, in any capacity, wherever we meet, then Torah can be what it's supposed to be, a Torah Chaim, a living Torah, that really was meant and still meant to be a partnership. And that's the bottom line, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu desires partnership with us. And that's what Talmud Torah is about. It's conversation. It's another name of a chapter in my second book, My Conversation with God. Talmud Torah is supposed to be conversation. And conversation is the primary way to relationship between human beings. There are other ways also. But the primary way we connect with people is through conversation. So, Yeratzon, should be God's will that we're inspired enough and brave enough to have conversation. If our interpretations are perhaps not as valid as other interpretations, or perhaps even more valid, we shouldn't be afraid to go ahead and try to come up with them and to learn our Torah, which is the way to being it our Torah, meaning not just ours here, but our Torah is something that we share with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. So I might have gone over my first rule, but I'm
going to
stick to my second rule. I will not take questions.
Thank you very, very much.
I mean, I'll take questions individually, socially, but not
okay.
Very nice.
Shall we go straight into it?
Why not? Yes.